All right, everyone, it's the Grim Lord here, and it's the Games and Rants show. No, it's Grim Articles with Grim. DP.
What's up?
Yeah, I'm a little out of sorts. Long story short, I'm getting off all the fucking heartburn shit, all of it. It's been screwing with me. I'm having stuff that has never happened to me before. I just think I'm gonna re-regulate my stomach back to what it was, and maybe things will calm the fuck down. I'm gonna try that. It's a rebound. People get scared and they go back to their PPIs, but I'm gonna try it and see what happens. And just baking soda. Baking soda for the rebound. I think baking soda might work for the rebound.
Watch what you drink. Mm-hmm. That's important.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna watch.
Make sure things with high acid, you know.
Yeah.
You try to limit.
Mm-hmm. I've been eating those soups.
At least 3 hours before bed.
Yeah, I know. And soups. I've been eating soups mostly. Soups are good.
Soups are good, but homemade soups are.
Oh, I know.
Probably what. You know, that high salt content will also hurt your acid reflux.
I know it will. But it didn't hurt as much as the D-limonene I took. Oh my god, I was talking about that. I didn't realize how bad that was going to be. But anyway, guys, it's been a rough time for me. Very rough. I literally sat and, because I have high anxiety, I sat and fucking Googled symptoms for hours and days.
Yeah,
I even was working. Even at work, I couldn't stop. And, I was getting my job done, but they weren't near to the quality that I'm capable of.
Yeah.
And all the managers were understanding. They knew something was wrong. There was even a day I didn't go to work. And you know what I did? I stood up and I tried. And I tried, man. And then I just stood up fucking Googling symptoms. I'm like, God damn, I've got to stop this. And, I talked about the acid watcher diet and all that bullshit. And I'm not fucking with that. I'm just going to eat what I know is going to be good for me. Basically, somebody said make a food journal.
Yeah, that doesn't hurt.
Make a food journal.
I'm just not good at keeping up with journals.
I can keep up with... Well, see, I have a memory. Right now, the D-limonene or whatever goddamn pills I was on, or lack of sleep or whatever, it's famotidine. Something's got me up. But anyway, I can really remember what the hell I'm going to be able to eat, what I can eat and what I can't eat. Oh, well, can't eat that. You know, because there is one time where I've even before all the GERD or whatever the fuck you want to call this shit, just regular acid reflux, where I was like, okay, I can't eat red sauce. Okay, I can't eat onions. They tear me up. Like, I knew that. I knew what I couldn't eat. I knew it was going to tear me up. There was a pizza that had onions on it. I couldn't eat it. It's going to tear me up.
Yeah.
So I switched to the version that didn't have onions. And the last day before I had all this, I had a pizza and an alcohol with Dr. Pepper. And, of course, I didn't have anything from that. The only thing that really frightened me about all this is I had a tickle and a cough. If you guys remember that, that was the same thing that happened last year. Now, this could be a seasonal thing because I did look that up. It could be a seasonal esophageal thing.
Well, you got to think, too, with the weather being hot one day, cold the next day.
It could be a seasonal thing. And, it's very good. So my mother said, it very well could be a seasonal issue. And, that's one thing I'm trying to keep track of. Because I'd use antibiotics to get rid of it. And a friend of mine, she told me I had eosinophilic esophagus, which is something that basically, it inflames during certain allergies.
Yeah.
And that makes sense.
That's possible. I'd get it checked by a doctor.
I know, but the only way you can do that is through a fucking endoscopy.
Yeah.
And that is...
Well, just wait till your insurance gets all cleared.
Yeah, I'll see what I can do with that.
Then get all of it worked up, because once you got insurance, it's pretty sweet.
I'll make sure
I'm 100% before my insurance gets cut off.
But, yeah, guys, I'm going to continue. We're not going to just talk about me and my issues. I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to handle it as I handled the fucking scary voice and whatever, the Veagle shit. It's been a goddamn mess of a year for me, folks. just ever since I had that Vegas nerve thing. But I will say, though, there's a possibility I might have had hiatal hernia. And if I did, that's okay. It's not... Most don't require surgery and can be fixed with just some simple maneuvers. There's actually... I'm going to teach you guys something. Here's something you guys can do. Even if you don't have a hiatal hernia, this will protect against it. So listen to me. What I want you to do is to drink a glass of water and then take your arms and put them up like against your chest, kind of like...
Put your...
Yeah, you...
Your fists against your chest.
Yeah, put your...
Your elbows out.
Yeah, stick your elbows out and just up against your chest, your fists up against your chest. And then I want you to stand on your tiptoes and then immediately drop down and do that 15 times.
Is it something with breathing while you're doing it?
No.
Oh, no?
They just said to drink the water. You drink the water and then you... Drop down 15 times, and then you breathe. You breathe 1, 2, 3, something like that. No, I think she was like, there's a woman that does it online that actually showed, this guy was showing his wife do it. And it's not hard, but you can do that, and there's also a massage thing. Now, I'm not going to tell you how to do that. You need to watch it. But it's something that you can do, and basically it's a chiropractic thing. Now, I thought you had to have a chiropractor to do it, but apparently a lot of people do it on their own. It's not that hard. It's not something that's super difficult. And you basically just push it down. You could, because you can lock your esophagus back into place, is what I'm saying. And if you lock your esophagus back into place, then all your GERD issues and all that shit will actually disappear. Because your stomach's where it's supposed to be, instead of up there in your fucking... rib cage.
Diaphragm,
and all that shit.
Yep.
And people keep getting their gallbladder removed. Don't get your gallbladder removed. Because it was, oh, it's your gallbladder. No, it's not your gallbladder. Gallbladder is important for storing bile. It's not just an organ you throw away. It's useful. So don't get rid of that.
Pancreas. That's one that we don't really know.
Yeah, that's the one we don't really need.
I
want
to say it regulates blood sugars or something.
It might. I haven't had any issue with my gallbladder. That's
what I've heard, rumor.
Because basically, if you have an issue with your gallbladder's right here. Gallbladder's right here.
Yeah.
So, if you touch it and it's painful, then you got an issue with your gallbladder. If you touch it and it's not painful, then you're good. Yeah. I touched my gallbladder. It doesn't hurt. I'm like, okay, cool. Gallbladder's all right. I didn't figure there was anything wrong with it. And some guy's like, oh, you got to check your gallbladder. He's like, they put mesh in my stomach, you know, for his issues. But yeah. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to do this naturally. I don't know what's going to happen as far as all this stuff here, but we're going to take it by ear. I'm going to just take everything off and try to bring things back to normal, and we'll see what happens.
I will say, too, if anyone gets a chance, I went and saw the new Spider-Man 3. Definitely go see it. It is worth seeing. And, oh, man, it's amazing. Then we saw our first, maybe not our first transgender, but definitely one.
Oh, yeah, tell this story.
Oh, man. I went to the bathroom after the movie, and my buddy was waiting outside for me to get done. And I came out, and he's like, did you see that girl just walk into the guy's bathroom? I said, well, it couldn't have been a girl because it was pissing in the urinal right next to me. And I'll tell you, it looked like a little Asian girl. But, yeah.
It was a little Asian man.
It was a little Asian man. I didn't hear him talk, but... I can only imagine what the voice sound like.
Ha! Oh, boy!
Oh, no.
Okay. Well, let's look at our chats. Okay, there's not much. Just, I heard that, too. The latest Spider-Man is pretty great.
Oh, yeah.
Winter says. Nightmare says it's really great. Yep, it's really good, guys. Oh, yeah. Go see it. Okay, but let's go ahead and get to the actual articles here, because that's what you're here for, and we're going to go ahead and give that to you. And, of course, we'll do brief commentary. Now, remember, I'm not myself, so, I mean, got to be careful. I might cough a bit, but we're going to try this. All right. Is this the most I've talked in a while? This will be the most I've talked in a while. Oh my god, you guys. Ooh, it's a lot of articles. We'll see what I can do.
Do your best.
Okay.
We'll take care of the rest.
Yeah, like I said. The San Francisco exodus isn't over, according to new migration data. Here's where people are moving. This is from... I don't know. Doesn't say. Anyway, for years, a similar number of people moved out of San Francisco as into it. But that changed during the pandemic. Excluding moves from abroad, over 72,000 more people have moved out of the city than since the beginning in 2020. A figure that is almost 8 times higher than the same period in 2018-2019. The Chronicle received an exclusive look at data on California migration patterns from the California Policy Lab, a research group based out of the University of California. The data, called the University of California Consumer Credit Panel, tracks movements of the approximately 90% of Californian adults with active credit information every quarter. It shows the number of Californians that have moved both within countries, within counties, and from other states. The data shows that during the pandemic, California had far higher levels of what's called negative net domestic migration compared to the prior 2 years. That is, the number of Californians leaving the state for other parts of the country has increased, while the number of people moving into the state from the rest of the U.S. has decreased. However, this change does not necessarily reflect a Cal exodus, the hyped-up concept of Californians leaving the state in droves. While move-outs have increased during the pandemic, the steep uptick in domestic out-migration stems mostly from fewer Americans entering California, not more Californians leaving the state. It's more about Cal entrances than Cal exits, Natalie Holmes, a research fellow at California Policy Lab and author of the report, told The Chronicle. Okay, so this is from The Chronicle.
That sounds a little fish. That sounds like something someone... Oh, no, no, no. California's still good. We ain't got people leaving. It's that not as many people are coming. Like, no, that's not how it works.
But, yeah, there's a lot here, but we're going to, like, people are still leaving San Francisco.
Yeah.
San Francisco saw a pronounced increase in outward migration during the pandemic. Net moves into the city were slightly negative before 2020 and began to decrease in the first half of the year. They then took a nosedive in the second half of that year and have not yet recovered to pre-pandemic levels. The decrease in net moves into San Francisco was driven almost equally by move-outs and fewer move-ins. Move-ins declined by about 24% during the pandemic compared to the prior 2 years, while move-outs increased by 21%. Again, it's important to remember that the data doesn't include all moves in and out of San Francisco, as internal migration is excluded. San Francisco to Montana connection. Out of all states, Montana saw the biggest increase in New Franciscans during the pandemic, followed by Utah. Shit, they're all going to Montana. The number of San Franciscans entering Montana and Utah increased by 140 and 186%, holy shit, respectively, compared to the pre-pandemic period. By sheer numbers, though, New York, Texas, and Washington received the most ex-San Franciscans during the pandemic. The most common points of origin from out-of-state people moving into San Francisco during their pandemic period were also New York, Texas, and Washington, though these states received far more San Franciscans than they gave up. As in San Francisco, more people are leaving California than moving into it during the pandemic, a trend that picked up in the fourth quarter of last year. However, California has been seeing net out-migration domestically for around a decade now, according to Evan White, executive director at the California Policy Lab and co-author of the report. There's been a slow decline in net entrances for a long time, White told The Chronicle. What appears to have happened in the pandemic was the slope of the line changed. The statewide trend is driven largely by a decrease in moves into California, not moves out of it. Moves into California decreased by about 35% between the pre-pandemic period we looked at, the pandemic period, while moves out increased only about 7% during that same period. Finally, the Bay Area was most impacted by the pandemic move. San Francisco, San Mateo, and Santa Clara saw the biggest increase in net move-outs as a share of the population over the pandemic period. San Francisco's increase in net move-outs was the largest by far. 74 more people per 1,000 residents left the country during the pandemic compared to the pre-pandemic period. Californians are not just going to Texas. Ex-Californians disproportionately move to a few states when they decide to leave the Golden State. By net moves, the most popular destination states for ex-Californians during the pandemic were Texas, Arizona, Nevada, and Washington. But the states that saw the biggest increases in arrival from California were Tennessee, Montana, and Idaho. Oh shit, Tennessee. Additionally, far fewer people moved from Colorado, New Jersey, and Vermont to California during the pandemic than they had in 2018-2019. Doesn't seem like they're going our way. Nope, I don't see it. Okay. The most common moves are not changing, though. The most common region-to-region moves in the state did not change much. Where they did, they reflected these other patterns in the movements of Californians and would-be Californians. Mm-hmm. Nearly all of the top 20 popular region-to-region movements were from one large county to another, such as Los Angeles to Orange to San Mateo or to Santa Clara. Still, several changes stuck out. Of the most popular outward moves, the pairing that saw the biggest increase was from Los Angeles to Texas. Net moves from L.A. to the Lone Star State increased by 20% from the pre-pandemic period to the pandemic. Hmm. So there you go.
I will say, I don't know if the homeless problems is big in Texas. I know when
It's gonna be.
I think my grandparents and my aunt and all them on my dad's side lived out in Arizona. And I don't know it they're as bad as California, because I've heard California's just gotten out of control with the homeless population. But I know when I went to Arizona, you would see homeless people everywhere, especially just hanging out in parks and just wandering. But yeah, it's crazy. But it kind of seems like they're moving to a lot of places where at least the weather's, I guess, sunny most of the year round.
Yeah. Well, we got, please do not break Daily Wire. Please do not break glass. San Franciscans leaving car trunks open to prevent smash and grab. Wow. This is where we're at, folks. In the robbery-infested areas of San Francisco and Oakland, California, we know that. Some residents are so fearful of having their cars broken into that they are deliberately leaving their car trunks open so robbers won't shatter the windows. We see the aftermath of car break-ins all too often. Windows smashed, glass shattered, but now some people are getting so fed up that they're leaving their trunks open, hoping that will at least spare them the hefty bill to get it fixed, ABC7 reported. People have even posted signs on their cars begging, "Please use the door, please do not break glass, nothing inside." One witness, seeing a trunk left wide open, posted on social media, "Imagine having to clean out your car and leaving it open in public just so people won't break your windows. Oakland, we looking sad, man." Right. Oakland's Deputy Interim Police Chief Drennan Lindsay, apprised that people were leaving their trunks open, admitted, "It doesn't really surprise me." Former Deputy San Francisco Deputy Police Chief Garrett Tom, who spent nearly 40 years on the force, said he'd never seen anything like it, commenting that leaving trunks open... was an invitation or disaster, adding they could steal your batteries or go into your glove compartment, find out where you live. If they leave their trunk open, some cars, depending on what car you have, you can still get inside to the interior. The SFPD has reported that 2021 has seen a 32% increase in car break-ins and 25% increase in auto burglaries compared to 2020 in Oakland. 2021 has seen a 27% increase in both categories over 2020. A family with young children... hold on. In the month of November, city data shows there were 3,375 reports of larceny theft in San Francisco. The overwhelming majority of those were car break-ins. SFPD Central District, home to tourist hotspots including Fisherman's Wharf and Chinatown, sees the highest number of smash and grabs, CBS San Francisco added. In mid-November, NBC Bay Area titled a piece, "SF suffers high rate of car break-ins compared to Atlanta, D.C., Dallas, L.A. Subheading it, the NBC Bay Area Investigative Unit wrote, along with undercover police officers, interviewed top law enforcement officials, and obtained and analyzed court and police records to find out why car burglaries remain one of the most prolific crimes in San Francisco. So there you go with that one. Just leaving their trunks open, use the door, don't smash my car window in. It's going to cost me too much to pay for it. That's where we're at right now, folks.
Oh, yeah. Well, everything's expensive now, I imagine. Plus, if it's in California, that's probably at least double what we're paying.
Right. The cream cheese shortage you heard about? Cyber attacks played a part. The cream cheese shortage wreaking havoc on bagel shops and bakeries is in part due to a cyber attack on the biggest U.S. cheese manufacturer. Schreiber Foods in Wisconsin, which makes cheese slices for most of the top burger chains in America and has a cream cheese business rivaling Kraft's, closed for days in October after hackers compromised its plants and distribution centers. While that may not sound like a long time, the company is big enough that the lost production shook U.S. markets. Making this situation worse, the shutdown occurred at the height of cream cheese demand. Americans are doing more holiday baking and buying more cakes, and cream cheese is a common dessert ingredient. People are still working and eating breakfast at home, so they're buying more cream cheese from grocery stores for their morning bagels. Add to that all the labor constraints and logistics headaches caused by the pandemic and the fact that cream cheese is fresh, so there aren't huge reserves. There just hasn't been enough schmear to go around. All this together has aggravated the cream cheese situation in the country, said Emma Ayer, chief executive officer of competing cream cheese producer Franklin Foods. We just can't keep up with the demand. Cyber attacks have added to the chaos afflicting global food supply chains in the COVID-19 era, with inflation driving prices to around decade highs. Hackers also targeted meat giant JBSSA in an Iowa grain cooperative this year. Remember that? Cream cheese happens to be particularly vulnerable to the supply chain issues. Some manufacturers have had problems getting starch, a thickening agent used in cream cheese, as well as packaging like plastic film and cardboard boxes, according to Andrew Novakovic, an agricultural economist at Cornell University. Cream cheese is a fresh product, meaning that keeping a large inventory on hand isn't plausible. On top of the widespread labor shortage across industries, finding truck drivers is hitting the dairy industry particularly hard because of the extra license needed to pick up milk from farms, Novakovic said. Meanwhile, demand keeps soaring. Schreiber Foods is running at full capacity at the time of cyber attack. Though the company was able to get its plants back up and running within 3 days, the event did impact production, and high demand for cream cheese hasn't changed, a spokesperson for Schreiber said in an email. Cream cheese production in October fell 6.9% from a year ago, according to government data. At home, cream cheese consumption is up 18% compared to 2019, and food service demand in November was up 75% compared to last year, said Kathy Kranger, spokesperson for Kraft Heinz. We are maximizing our production to meet the unprecedented demand, she said in an email. For the first time in 71 years of business, Junior's Cheesecake in New York City ran out of cream cheese. The business closed down its baking for a day and a half to drive from the New York area to Philadelphia to pick up cream cheese rather than wait for delivery. Without it, we can't make a cheesecake, owner Alan Rosen said in a phone interview. There's no substitute. Rosen said demand is increasing even more than usual in the company's busiest season as people look for comfort food in the pandemic. The company, which bakes about 5 million cakes a year, is using 4 million pounds of cream cheese. Using 4 million pounds of cream cheese, is seeing its grocery business increase across the board, and is up 43% year-to-date in wholesale. Bagels on a Sunday with a smear is one thing, but Christmas without cheesecake is another, Rosen said. Wow. Okay, we've got another one. Los Angeles Times. A lot of stuff from California here. Remember, it's your articles. I cover what you want, rather. You post it, I cover it. I'll get it right. Retailers say theft is at crisis levels. The numbers say otherwise. Organized retail crime is haunting the nation this holiday season. Captured on smartphones and closed-circuit cameras, thefts involving groups of people smashing windows or individuals wheeling loaded shopping carts past security guards and out the door have been looping on social media and TV news, raising the specter that crime rings reselling boosted merchandise present a major threat to retailers. With industry groups sounding the alarm, politicians have declared the issue a priority. California Governor Gavin Newsom said he would increase the budget on the California Highway Patrol next year to beef up its organized retail theft task force. California Attorney General Rob Bonta met with retailers, online marketplace companies, and law enforcement Tuesday to develop strategies to fight organized retail crime. Police prosecutors say criminal justice reforms need to be rolled back to deter smashing grabs. Although some retail and law enforcement lobbyists cite eye-popping figures, there's no reason to doubt the problem is anywhere near as large or widespread as they say. The best estimates available put losses around 7 cents per $100 of sales on average. It's easy to get attention for sensational claims, however, particularly when they come from official sources. Rachel Mitchline, president of the California Retailers Association, told the San Jose Mercury News, San Jose Mercury News, that in San Francisco and Oakland alone, businesses lose $3.6 billion to organized retail crime each year. That would mean retail gang steal nearly 25% of total sales in San Francisco and Oakland combined, which amounted to $15.5 billion in 2019, according to a state agency to track sales tax. Can that be right? In a word, no. Well, this is long as fuck, by the way, so we won't cover all of it. The country's largest retail group, the National Retail Federation, estimated its latest report that losses from organized retail theft averaged $700,000 per $1 billion in sales, or 0.7 total sales, an amount roughly 330 times the CRA's estimate. As to how the organization arrived at that figure, CRA staffers said that there's no way of knowing exactly how much organized retail crime affects the bottom line of businesses. The staffer said the estimate was based on a back-of-the-napkin circulation. If organized retail thieves steal $70 billion annually and California accounts for 10% of the U.S., California losses add up to $7 billion, meaning the Bay Area is likely in the billions itself. Leaving aside some of those assumptions, how do they come up with that $70 billion number? The staffer pointed to a report from the Retail Industry Leaders Association published this year. But their report didn't find that organized retail thieves stole $68.9 billion per year at all. It estimated all retail crime combined, including employee theft, regular shoplifting, and fraud, added up to that number. Yeah, we're not covering this whole fucking thing. Because it's just a lot. We basically understand that there's a lot of retail theft and reselling going on in that area.
See, we had that last year with the PS5s.
Yep.
And it was management that was behind it.
And Hoshioni adds that they're recovering $20 million in merchandise stolen. All right, give me just a second. Okay, we got another one. This is old. Let me see how long it is. Long enough. This is July 10th of 2021. Why progressive women want to date men who act like conservatives?
Because they're frauds.
My friend Mark, 36, is a catch by many New York City standards. He's good-looking, highly educated, and a talented photographer. He's also progressive and participates in protests and gives to left-leaning causes. And Mark is looking for love. He wants to get married and have kids. In a liberal city like New York, swimming with single women wishing they weren't, one could assume Mark wouldn't have a problem finding a mate. And while he dates, he recently had a couple of short-lived relationships. Mark remains single. He's trying to understand why. I'm really open-minded and cool about gender stuff on dates, but I always feel like I'm walking on eggshells, Mark told me. If I pay for dinner, it signals I don't value my date as my equal, so I'm super casual about it all. If she wants to pay or spit or whatever,
If she wants to spit, she can find a different guy today. Not for me.
That's fine with me. I told Mark that despite his best intentions, his egalitarian dating style could be the problem that's holding him back. While some women balk at any kind of traditional male gender behavior, more lament the loss of chivalry. I'm one of them. I find it attractive when a man plans out our first few dates and knowingly walks curbside when we're together. It signals he wants to protect me from passing traffic or errant puddle splashes. When I was a kid, my mom told me to always walk curbside, but I assume my generation of women would think it's old-fashioned, Mark told me. Now I'm really confused. The female desire to feel protected and looked after is built into our DNA, says evolutionary psychologist Jeffrey Miller, professor at the University of New Mexico and author of several books, including The Mating Mind. It's a mismatch between what progressive women say they want and what they actually respond to, Miller told me. Women's instinctive mate preferences have evolved for hundreds of thousands of years for guys who are competent, strong, good providers, good protectors, and happy with the sexual division of labor, he added. Women want decisive men who are also compassionate and thoughtful. A 2018 study from Iowa State University backs this up, reporting that progressive women prefer men who demonstrate more traditional dating behaviors. The women found these men to be more attractive because they signal a willingness to invest by being protective, committed, and providing resources. Gwen Stefani presumably has no doubt of these findings.
Well, she was talking, I was watching a thing the other day, they're talking about, she went and stayed with Blake, her and her family.
Yeah.
And said, there's a tree in the road. He said, I'll get that. And he got out and got his chainsaw and started cutting. They're like, oh my God, it's a real man. Like, they ain't ever seen one. They're from California. And,
On July 3rd, the pop star, who was raised in Blue State, California, wed country and western star Blake Shelton, a native of Red State, Oklahoma, who was pro-gun and a famous gentleman. Shelton even asked Defoni's father for his blessing before proposing in the Catholic wedding chapel he built for his bride. When asking what he loves about her betrothed, Defoni gushed, "He's full of love and generosity, so you feel safe. You can lean on him and trust him." My friend Rock, 44, exemplifies the same type of old-school man. His girlfriend, 36, is a typical New York City progressive feminist, he said. "Before me, she dated liberal artists and creatives. I work in corporate America and am much more conservative and methodical. I pay for stuff, open doors, and she likes that I walk on her right side because she has a mild case of scoliosis," he added. The couple has been together for 5 years. Carl, 45, is a fundraising executive who dated a man in 2018 with similar left-leaning values and beliefs. But before long, his egalitarian dating attitude and lack of initiative to plan dates led to a breakup. "At work, I'm the boss. I have to run the show, be the cheerleader. I have tough conversations," she told me. "I make decisions all day long. At the end of the day, I want my guy to say, 'Babe, I got this.'" Kari's next boyfriend was a conservative who works in finance. "Without fail, he would pick the place, set the time, then ask if his plan worked for me," she said. "It felt great to know he was taking care of it all. I appreciate a man who opens the doors for me and picks up the check. This makes me feel safe, like I can count on him for other things," Carrie said, adding, "I'm grateful when a man steps up and acts like a man. It makes me feel more feminine." When Carrie and her boyfriend broke up for reasons outside of political views, she remains a feminist who will only date conservative men, although she draws the line at far-right conspiracy theorists. While she met her most recent ex on a plane, she's now using dating apps to find her next love, and she says she's more likely to swipe right on profiles of men who say they prefer more traditional dating behaviors. "It's a good indicator that there's a shared mindset," Kari said. Kari's preferences for conservative men comes as no surprise to Professor Miller. "This is a time-tested set of behavior strategies and cultural norms that have lasted for centuries because they help find and keep good mates," he said. "And everybody knows this. Women in their hearts know this. And men don't take them at their word. Now, my friend Mark is planning to stop making the same mistakes. He told me he's going to start dating like a conservative and hopefully find his ideal progressive wife soon."
Well, you gotta think, too, progressive is more based on trends and fashion. And so if you're more concerned with what's trending and what's fashionable to say or do, conservatism
yeah.
and all that, it's consistent. It's got the same values and they don't change no matter what the style or trend is. You know, you just know to do them.
Right.
And so, yeah, consistency, and that falls in line with something women want for long term. But, yeah.
Right.
Usually you're more manly too when you have some sort of conservative values, it seems like. That, you know, all my friends that are conservative, we all hunt, we all...
Mm-hmm. Well, they want men, not women.
Cut wood,
yeah.
Do everything else that a guy likes to do, blow stuff up.
Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, have fun.
Okay.
Not worry about what people think.
Right.
I think that's the biggest thing. Women love guys that don't give a shit what people think about them.
Right. Well, we've got one from Boston News. Lancaster woman hanging Christmas lights attacked by raccoon. Wow. Lancaster, Massachusetts. Donna Sanginario, all 4'10" of her, had the fight of her life with what she described as a 40-pound raccoon.
Oh, good lord.
While hanging Christmas lights. She probably exaggerated.
Oh, I'll tell you, a raccoon any size is mean as shit.
Yeah, I know.
I've had one in the cage that I've had to feed of my cousins.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the water bottle and it reached through and clawed the
no, yeah, it will.
Hand. And if it could have bit me, it would have.
Oh, I know they will.
And I punched it in the nose.
Yeah, the fight of... Okay. Well, hanging Christmas lights last Wednesday. I got him. Finally rolled over and had him choking. And he's biting me up here. And I'm screaming and he's screeching, San Gennaro said. She says the attack happened right outside her front door. I just came out without my coat to put on these little twinkles over there on the bushes, she said. At first, she tells Boston 25 she heard this growling noise, which at first she thought was a passing car, but it was no vehicle. And I looked, it was a huge raccoon that was just like 10 feet from me. So I tried to take a step back, and he jumped right in my face, she said. Centenario used her arm to cover her head. She shared pictures to show the bite marks up and down her arm and bloodstained Patriots sweatshirt. I was screaming, he was screaming. I got him tossed in the air, then off me, finally, once I threw him to the ground, and he jumped right back at me, she said. At last resort, she dropped to the ground. I finally got him in the neck and under my elbow here, under my shoulder. He's biting and screaming. I'm yelling to my neighbors, please, someone come help me, she said. But no one heard her. Then suddenly, as quickly as it started, it was over.
Serious, but good.
Yeah, I know.
Can you imagine looking out your window and seeing a woman rolling around with a raccoon? Like, what? This put your alcohol down.
Here, hold my beer.
Drinking like this.
So finally, he did stop moving and he got up, looked at me and walked away. It's crazy. It's crazy and it's scary. I'm just glad I'm alive, she said. San Gennaro is on the mend and is sore. She's had 2 rabies shots and needs more. Her biggest concern now, police and her husband couldn't find the raccoon. She's just hoping this doesn't happen to someone else.
Yeah, raccoons are, sometimes they're extremely aggressive. They say not even feed them because if you stop feeding them, they will become aggressive because you're not giving them what they want. They expect you to give it to them. No questions asked. Or they'll fuck you up.
Wow.
Yeah, they're mean.
What the hell? Damn, Phoenix.
I've seen them tear up.
Justice are them. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I've seen them tear up full-grown dogs that they're trained on.
Damn.
And just, you know, their teeth are razor sharp. I never knew how sharp, but until one gets a hold of you, this is a good story. One time I was driving, had a girl in the car with me,
mm-hmm.
and a raccoon ran out in front of me. Boom, boom, hit it. I get out, throw it in the back of my truck. She said, "What was that?" I was like, "Don't worry about it." It kept driving. And we get halfway into town, and all of a sudden you hear it rattling around. And she said, "What is that?" I said, "Oh, it's a raccoon. It's probably just rolling around in the truck bed." She's, "You get rid of that right now." So I pulled up to my uncle's house. And I said, "I'll throw it out in the ditch and I'll pick it up on the way back." I went to throw it and that thing latched onto my arm and I just slung it real quick and got in the truck and took off. Well, they were renting their mm-hmm. yard to some people that were foremen for construction, and the wife was out getting the paper. And I went to our family Christmas party and my cousin was telling a story about, "It is the darndest thing. So-and-so went out to get the paper, and this raccoon chased her around the yard."
Wow.
And I knew that moment that was the raccoon I threw in their ditch.
All right. Well, we've got North Bay man takes his own life by guillotine. Home taken over by a squat by meth heads who disposed of body. Wow, another story of a squat where some probably meth-addicted squatters ignored or otherwise forgot about human remains in order to occupy an empty house. There's a lot of methamphetamine use involved in this story, says Sonoma County Deputy District Attorney Matthew Hubley, speaking to Santa Rosa Press Democrat about a gruesome and sad tale of a Santa Rosa man who took his own life via makeshift guillotine, only to have his remains tossed aside by some squatters.
Oh, wow.
It's not clear when 62-year-old homeowner Robert Enger finally actually died. As the Chronicle relays via the Press Democrat, Enger was last seen alive by a neighbor in July 2019 when he approached that neighbor's house in need of medical help, after injuring himself and bleeding from the head. It was later determined by investigators that this was likely his first bot suicide attempt using guillotine contraption he built himself. The machine apparently was fitted with a large metal spike, not a blade, and at some point thereafter, Enger got it to work and took his own life. Neighbors say that in years past, Enger was a pleasant neighbor who even once helped construct an addition on a neighbor's home. But they describe what sounds like a descent into mental illness. And Enger described being abused by an older Marine in his youth, an event that he had detailed in a handwritten poster that he had facing out of the front window of his home at one point. Around the fall of 2020, some meth heads found the darkened house in Santa Rosa's Luther Burbank neighborhood and began having parties there that attracted unwanted attention from neighbors and law enforcement, beginning at least around New Year's Eve of 2020. According to the Press Democrat, one neighbor who accompanied police on an inspection of the party house saw the 20-foot contraption that turned out to be Enger's guillotine. Enger, a contractor and craftsman by trade, had fashioned a trusty macabre way to kill himself, which he would later perfect, and investigators describe how he had even cut a hole into the roof of his home to accommodate this device jutting out. And it's not a proper guillotine, but it's a self-impalement device, and the Press Democrat is a police photo of the spike-impaled skull if you want to look. It wasn't until March of this year, though, that a woman called police to say she found a human skull in the bushes while working in her brother's garden, which is about a half mile away from Enger's house. Robert Melvin Ross III was arrested in Santa Rosa on an unrelated crime, and it was only after this he told police in an interview I'd come to find Enger's remains. Ross had heard about the abandoned house from others, and he posted a note to the homeowner on the front of the door to determine if it was empty. After the note remained there for several weeks, he moved in. This all connected back to a story told to them by another suspect who claims to have partied with Ross at the home and seen him lift up a human skull, scrape flesh from it with a knife, and impale with a wire so it could be carried around by a handle. That person also described seeing bones or a body which was concealed under trash and debris at the base of the large device. Santa Rosa Police Violent Crimes Detective Anthony Turner tells the Press Democrat that Ross gave them a description of the guillotine and how he found the body at the bottom of the contraption. Ross also explained that he'd physically removed the head from the device himself using a knife. Ross pleaded no contest in November to one count of possession of a memento from human remains, which carries a possible 3-year sentence. The Press Democrat describes via court records how Ross subsequently tried to withdraw this plea, rambling in court about corrupt judges, the DA, and other officials, and something about his father calling in the case to the White House and to Donald Trump. Ross will be back in court on December the 20th, at which point he may be sentenced and a judge will hear the motion to withdraw the plea. Ross's mental competence has previously been in question by the court. The biggest question in the case is why the police didn't do more between December of 2020 when they first entered the house and found it in a disgusting state with the evidence of squatting, and March 2021 when the skull was found and more investigation occurred. Multiple police visits, spurred by neighbors, brought descriptions of buckets full of feces and urine in a situation that clearly became a public health hazard, not to mention rotting human remains under some garbage. The case is oddly reminiscent of another from Las Vegas in which a group of squatters recently confessed to finding a woman dead in her living room chair, and disposing of the body in the backyard so they could live there. Anyway, sad and gross. Yep.
What a great soundtrack for this game.
That's the clown world music.
Afro circus, polka dot, afro.
Yeah. Okay, state police. Okay, we have one here. Go Erie. State police ID suspect in Summit Goodwill store pooping. Say he admitted to 2 incidents. Pennsylvania State Police troopers said they have identified the source of some unwanted defecation deposited inside a Goodwill store in Summit Township. The agency reported late Monday night that they believe a 71-year-old Erie man is responsible for relieving himself on the floor in the employee area of the store at 7200 Peach Street in the Summit Town Center at December the 6th and also on September the 23rd. The man admitted to the acts when troopers interviewed him last week. According to investigators, he faces a charge of open lewdness, a third-degree misdemeanor, as well as counts of criminal mischief and disorderly conduct, state police in Erie reported. No criminal charges have been docketed against the man as of Tuesday morning. The public pooping came to light last week when Pennsylvania Crime Stoppers posted information about the December 6th incident on its website and sought help for the state police in identifying the man. The posting also stated that a cash reward could be available to anyone who provided information leading to an arrest. According to information provided by state police late Monday night, the man walked into the Goodwill store shortly after 2:30 p.m. on December the 6th and went into the employees-only area at the back of the store. The man then approached a row of cabinets, lowering his pants and defecated on the floor before leaving the store, troopers reported. The man's mess was found hidden behind a shovel a few minutes after the man returned to the store and pretended to shop, according to state police. Authorities reported last week that the man is suspected of committing a similar act at the store in the past. Investigators said the case was cracked on Thursday when a store employee got the license plate registration of the suspect's vehicle when he was leaving the store. State police traced the vehicle to the man's residence when they later interviewed him. He confessed to the act on December 6th as well as a similar act on September 23, the state police reported. So there we go. And it's just an old man relieving himself, you know. He probably doesn't even... Maybe doesn't realize what's going on.
I don't know. There's...
Okay. I guess we do have one more from Justice here, and then we're done. I don't really like this article, but we'll cover it anyway.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff about death. Maker of suicide plan of suicide pod plans to launch in Switzerland. Company behind a 3D printed pod which can help carry out assisted suicide is said it's confident could be used in Switzerland as early as next year. Sarko commissioned a Swiss legal expert who found the machine did not break any laws in the country, but other lawyers questioned his findings. An assisted suicide organization, Dignitas, said it would be unlikely to meet much acceptance. Assisted suicide, in which somebody is given the means to end their own life, is legal in Switzerland. About 1,300 people died there this way in 2020. Jesus. Both assisted suicide and euthanasia, in which a doctor ends the life of somebody who wants to die, are illegal in the UK. Current method used in Switzerland is to provide the person with a series of liquids that, if ingested, will end the person's life. By contrast, the pod, which can be anywhere, is flooded with nitrogen. Oh my god, reducing the oxygen levels rapidly. The process would make the person inside lose consciousness and die in 10 minutes. The suicide pod is activated from the inside, also has an emergency button to exit. Daniel Hollerman, a legal expert and assistant professor at the University of St. Gallen, was asked by Sarko to explore whether the use of suicide pod would break any Swiss laws. He told the BBC that his findings suggested the pod did not constitute a medical device that would not be covered by the Swiss Therapeutic Products Act. He also believed it would not fall foul of laws governing the use of nitrogen weapons or product safety. This means that the pod is not covered by Swiss law, he said. But Kirsten Noah Wikinger, a doctor, lawyer, and professor at the University of Zurich, told Swiss newspaper Neue Zeitung, medical devices are regulated because they are supposed to be safer than other products. Just because a product is not beneficial to health does not mean that it is not also affected by those additional safety requirements. And Dignitas told the BBC, for 35 years now, through the two Swiss exit groups, and for 23 years also with Dignitas, Switzerland has the practice of professional accompanied suicide with trained staff in cooperation with physicians. In light of the established faith and professionally conducted supported practice, we would not imagine that a technologized capsule for a self-determined end of life will meet much acceptance or interest in Switzerland. If the machine gets the go-ahead for use in Switzerland, the pod will not be offered for sale in the conventional way. Instead, the capsule's creator, Dr. Philip Nitschke, said he planned to make the blueprints available so anyone could download a design. This will be made available for free. His aim is to demedicalize the dying process, he said in an interview published on the Exit International website, a voluntary assisted dying charity which he founded. We want to remove any kind of psychiatric review from the process and allow the individual to control the method themselves. He has long campaigned for the right to die, earning him the nickname Dr. Death. Currently, there are two prototypes of the Sarko pod, with a third being printed in the Netherlands. Dr. Nitschke has previously faced criticism in the pod, with some saying that his futuristic design glamorizes suicide. Let's see here. We'll end with this funny one.
Oh, yeah.
We'll end because that was a little
morbid. Yeah, we need something happy, damn it.
We need something happy.
It's just depressing.
Right. The Irish Times wants to know, why are men still explaining things to women?
Because they have to.
Mansplaining illuminates a much deeper problem than the bore of patronizing monologues. It's common. He said, would you please stop talking? The Girl from Hills Like White Elephants, 1927, by Ernest Hemingway. It's common. It's cringeworthy. And it's been documented, some might argue, since the 17th century. Hold on. Let me make sure that this article, it's not that long. It's pretty short. Okay. Oh, pardon. Oh, burping up the orange again. But the acid's still coming. In bar rooms and in classrooms, famous men do it, uncles do it, politicians, colleagues, bad dates, bureaucrats, and neighbors do it. Some of you may do it ironically in response to reading this. Yes, we're talking about mansplaining. The portmanteau describes the act of a man's unsolicited explaining, generally to a woman, something he thinks he knows more about than she does. Occasionally the anesthetizing length, whether he knows anything or not. The apt articulation of this phenomenon began with Rebecca Solnit's 2008 essay, Men Explain Things to Me, which describes a conversation with a man at a party whose eyes were fixed on the... Hold on. Fixed on the fuzzy far horizon of his own authority. After he discovers that Solnit's latest book was about British photographer Edward Muybridge, he cut her off to pontificate relentlessly on a very important Muybridge book he thinks he should read. Turns out it was her book, and he hadn't read it. By Solnit's telling, it took 3 or 4 injections by her friend to get through to the mansplainer that Solnit was indeed the author before he'd finally heard of it. Tellingly, it also took time for Solnit to recognize the book he was referring to was in fact her own. So caught up was I in my assigned role as ingenue, that I was perfectly willing to entertain the possibility that another book on the same subject had come out simultaneously and I somehow missed it. The word mansplain was inspired by that essay. Today it's an ever-evolving list of international iterations exists. In German, it's Herklerin. Or Herklerin. In French, it's Mixblicker. Italians have Meschiagazone.
That doesn't sound German.
It's Italian.
Italian?
German, it's Herklerin. In French, it's Mixblicker. Italians have Meschiagazone. Yeah, Meschiagazone. There's a Spanish version of mansplain, and there's even a word for it in Russia, Arabic, Hebrew, Hindi, Mandarin, Ukrainian, Japanese, and dozens of other languages.
And mansplaining. It's just called explaining everywhere else.
Mansplaining illuminates a much deeper problem than the bore of patronizing monologues. As Solnit notes, it crushes young women into silence by telling them that this is not their world. She adds, it trains us in self-doubt and self-initiation just as it exercises men's supported overconfidence. More than a decade on, why a man's interruption of women to explain things, often things they know less about than men. What? Hold on, they know often... Hold on. Often things they know less about than the women to whom they're explaining, so common.
You know, maybe, but usually most people explaining something...
There's a question and answer here at the end. We'll go through that, too. Kate Mann, an associate professor of philosophy at Cornell University, explores the issue in a chapter of her new book entitled, How Male Privilege Hurts Women.
Oh, that's horseshit.
On a recent call from her home in upstate New York where she lives with her husband, their 8-month-old and a corgi, she unpacked the problem. How do we arrive at the idea that men are the authorities of knowledge? Mansplaining may be recently named, but it's most like a phenomenon as old as time. Inherent in patriarchy is men's entitlement to all valuable human goods. Things like love, care, adoration, sex, power, and knowledge. When it comes to knowledge, especially of a prestigious sort, the idea that men have a prior claim to it is as venerable as the patriarchy itself. Sometimes it's connected to the idea that women are incapable of being authority figures. In politics, for example, Aristotle wrote, "The slave is wholly lacking the deliberative element the female has, but it." Hold on. "The slave is wholly lacking the deliberative element the female has it, but lacks authority."
You know.
Did you catch that? Yeah, they're basically saying that the slave lacks the deliberative element, but the female has that, but lacks authority. The female doesn't have the authority.
If anything, it's female privilege is fucking everything up lately. You know?
Right.
That burns my biscuits. But, yeah. You know, it's not the man that, you know, gets the kids and the house and all that if he decides he's not happy with his marriage.
Right.
But,
it surely isn't. We know from the classic John versus Jennifer study at Yale that both men and women hold biases that women are less competent. Is this an essential part of mansplaining? Absolutely. Part of what's going on is the presumption that a woman would be less knowledgeable, less competent, and somehow in need of a man to explain things to her. That doesn't explain the fact that mansplaining also involves men's resistance to evidence, that the woman is more knowledgeable on the subject than he is, and sometimes to anger when that turns out to be the case. Why do some men explain even when they know of a woman's qualifications? I connect it to the sense of entitlement of certain privileged men to be the expert, the knower in exchange, whereas paradigmatically, the expert woman is ingenue, she keeps using that word, in need of his injection of information, as Rebecca Solnit put it. You say privileged men, but men who are less privileged aside from their maleness also mansplain. While it tends to be worse with men who are more privileged, there's a powerful gender dynamic where he's often been socialized to feel like he's authority. Girls, on the other hand, are socialized to be pleasing and polite, to not embarrass men. Absolutely, there's a very strong sense in women that she should provide a pleasant audience to him. One that doesn't interrupt him. Correcting someone is an inherently hierarchical act. And saying, you're wrong, I'm right. Jumping in when he's mistaken or less expert is inverting the gender hierarchy. Even though a woman is perfectly entitled to intervene, it's perceived by men who feel entitled to a smooth exchange as a socially abrupt, rude, and even a form of violence. Because it disrupts the status quo and overturns his position as a default authority in the exchange. Does interruption go hand in hand with mansplaining? Yes, it's linked to the same sense of entitlement to be the knower and the one who issues explanations. That sort of epistemic entitlement makes it very natural to speak over others and hold the floor for longer than is proper. It also makes men more willing to assume the floor. 2004 study of Harvard Law students found that men were 50% more likely to offer at least one comment in class and nearly 150% more likely to volunteer to speak three times or more. What's an example of mansplaining in culture? In Ernest Hemingway's short story, Hell's Like White Elephants, a man and his pregnant girlfriend are sitting at a bar waiting for a train. He tries to convince her that having an abortion is perfectly simple, as well as making no space in the conversation for her own reservations, desires, and plans. He keeps repeating himself. Finally, the woman has enough. Would you please, 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 please stop talking? As a reader, it's hard not to echo sentiments. Himpathy is the idea that we feel sorry for men even when they've behaved abhorrently. How do himpathy and mansplaining go together? Why does everything start with a, like, him, he, man? Himpathy is what I think of as the excessive or undue sympathy given to men over their female victims in case of misogynistic behavior, like sexual assault. Himpathy and mansplaining interact by making us feel sorry for men we would otherwise sharply correct. We feel presumptively sorry for him if he would feel humiliated or even chastened for being corrected. And it makes us feel guilty or even ashamed for thinking of it. To avoid being a mansplainer, what should a man ask himself? A. Is she interested? Did she express some desire to have this information imparted to her? Do I know this? Is she more expert than I am? Might she be asking a merely rhetorical question? What?
Oh, so if she asked a rhetorical question, you answered that's mansplaining.
Yeah.
Now that's just entrapment. You know.
That's entrapment.
They don't want equality. They want superiority.
Absolutely. Maybe look at her face? Yeah, read the room. If other people are registering profound discomfort, that might be a sign that you've made a misstep in the dialogue. And that was the end of the articles for today, anyway.
That kind of piss you off.
Yeah, it does. That's the stuff that they're trying to talk about here. Okay, I'm going to read the chats, and then we're going to end the show and go into the open mic. All right, California. Clown World, says Winter. Nightmare, sissy bitch equals progressive man. Okay, I think that's all we've got for you guys tonight. So, thank you guys for tuning in. I'm sorry, my voice hasn't been great. I'm still trying to, I guess it's this D-limonene orange stuff that's acid just coming up, man.
Oh, yeah.
Coming up, making me cough.
I may start my car in a minute, let it run. Do open mic for a minute.
Yeah, that'll work, sir.
Let it melt my windshield.
Yeah. It's also really bad weather right now, so that's a big thing. There's a big possibility. Like I said, I don't know if I said this on the show, but I might have seasonal stuff that's going on. Because I already had to correct this shit before, so.
Oh, yeah.
With antibiotics and steroids. Yeah. So, I don't know. It might happen again. I might actually go see my doctor tomorrow after all.
Well, just if he can afford it.
I can. I've got money.
Oh, yeah?
I've got money that I can use. I got to pay them for the last bill, and then I got they'll do this. But yeah, this is conversation for other things. So let's go ahead and thank you guys for joining us, and I hope you guys will stick around for the next one. You know, we'll
for that get them.
Well, yeah, we'll get them as soon as we can. You know, I'm trying here. I've got a lot of anxiety over all this. I'm trying to work with it. You know how it is, guys. At any rate, this is the Grim Lord. I am out of here.
Later.
Joy to the Kalani.